From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandy. Well, Tom Sherwood is not here today. He has not yet returned from the Republican National Convention. So we have a guest star today. He is Mike DeBonis. He covers Congress and national politics for the Washington Post. He formerly covered D.C. politics. DeBonis, good to see you.
Hey, Kojo. I was working on my Georgia drawl for today, but work out.
Nobody can do the Georgia drawl like Tom Sherwood, and I think he mimics it, too. I suspect he's not really from Georgia at all. However, since you are the guest star analyst today, you get to discuss anything we want to before we ambush interview Congressman Jerry Connolly.
Anything we want. I mean, you know, I went to bed last night after watching Donald Trump's speech, and I'm not quite sure what country I'm waking up in here. We had a presidential nominee of a major party in the United States paint a very bleak picture of the country and the times that we are living in, and I think that we talk about us here in Washington living in a bubble sometimes, and I'm curious to know that is the rest of the country experiencing are we really living in the same country as Donald Trump seems to be making it out, and I think that a lot of people were struck by this.
A crime wave domestically and international terrorism cornering us globally. I don't know. Joining us in studio is Jerry Connolly. He's a U.S. representative representing Virginia's 11th district. He's a Democrat. Congressman Connolly, thank you for joining
us. Great to be back with you, Koja.
If you have questions or comments for the congressman, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Very lively Republican convention in Cleveland wrapped up last night. We've heard a little bit of Mike DeBonis' thoughts. What are your thoughts on the final night and Donald Trump's speech?
I think it was the longest and darkest speech ever given by a nominee of a major party at a party convention. I felt watching it and listening to it, I was in a parallel universe. It was this dystopian, gloomy, dark, Gotham-like speech had no hope, no vision. I felt like I was in a sequel to the Batman series. It was very disturbing and had tones of demagoguery and authoritarianism that I think ought to alarm all of us who care about our country.
Well, how do you think it'll play in Virginia come November? Donald Trump presumably assumes that there are people in Virginia who share his, what you characterize as, dystopian vision.
Virginia's now a competitive state, thank God, and we're going to compete for it, and we're going to compete with these competing visions. And I believe, I'm confident at the end of the day, once again, we will carry Virginia for Hillary Clinton and the Democratic ticket.
Well, Hillary Clinton is expected to announce her vice presidential pick, possibly even sometime today. The informed speculation is that who is that likely to be, Mike DeBonis?
None other than Virginia's Senator Tim Kaine, former governor, former mayor of Richmond, Virginia.
Is that what you're hearing, Congressman Connolly?
I hear that, too, but I have no inside knowledge. I certainly hope it's true. I think she would be very well served with Tim Kaine. He's highly motivated, articulate, successful, very authentic political figure, and will add a great deal to the ticket, especially in contrast to the other ticket.
Well, this could conceivably have a domino effect on Virginia politics in a closely divided Senate. But what happens if he's chosen? Tell us the complicated scenario that follows.
Yeah, in the event that Tim is selected as Hillary Clinton's running mate and is successful in November, come January, the governor is entitled to appoint a temporary successor. But Virginia law requires that individual has to seek election in a special election in the next scheduled general election. That is November of 17. It also just so happens that Tim's term expires in November of 18. So the individual nominated presumably would have to run in November of 17 and again a year later in November of 18. That means this is a mega dollar race. This is an enormously costly enterprise. And in 2017, it would be the only Senate race in the United States.
There's also been speculation in the Washington Post that the governor may nominate a placeholder, like former Governor Doug Wilder, somebody who is not likely to run for the six-year term in 2018. How would you see that scenario unfolding?
Well, again, that individual would either be a placeholder until November of 17.
Okay.
Or would have to run in his or her own right, and then you're not really a placeholder. So it doesn't get around the dilemma that the appointment really is for 10 months. And if you're successful in that special election, you've got to turn around and do it again. So you're going to spend 22 months of heavy-duty fundraising and campaigning, whether you like it or not. It's the only way to hold the seat. And one can expect a huge amount of outside money. Imagine what the Koch brothers are going to do with the only Senate contest in the United States in November 17. So it's going to be, you know, a world-class struggle and fight, whoever's nominated.
Keep in mind, possibly with a very closely divided Senate, you know, after this year's elections, you know, Democrats are hoping to take back the Senate, but even if they do, it's only going to be by a couple of seats. This could be could be very important for the balance in the Senate. And
yeah.
Congressman, I'll just go ahead and ask you. You talk about how onerous this process is going to be, and how difficult it would be for a politician to go through this. Is this something that you'd be willing to entertain if Governor McAuliffe came to you and asked if you'd be willing to serve?
You know, I just would not presume to comment on that. This is the prerogative of the governor, and I'm simply commenting on some of the factors I know he's going to have to weigh in whatever he decides to do in this eventuality. Right now, I'm focused on hopefully Tim Kaine being the running mate and campaigning vigorously for the ticket. We got a task right in front of us, and that's not next January. It is making sure Donald Trump never gets close to the Oval Office.
And this is where I play Tom Sherwood and point out that was not a denial.
Well, people should know that Congressman Connie is one of the names that has been mentioned.
Absolutely.
That the governor could be appointing to this position. Hence, he doesn't want to comment on it.
Well, I do. Let me just... I love the Senate. I worked there for 10 years in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I revere the institution. But I also love the House of Representatives. I'm proud and privileged to be a member. I'm already in Congress and serving my district, and I love what I do. So I'm not looking for something else. But at the end of the day, this is pure and simple the prerogative of the governor, and he's going to have to weigh lots of factors in this eventuality.
Please put on your headphones, because there's a John in Conestoga, Pennsylvania, who has an opinion about whether or not Hillary Clinton chooses Tim Kaine. Go ahead, John. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's Conestoga, like the Conestoga wagon, Cojo.
Ah, Conestoga.
Yes, and I've been reading lately what Kaine has been saying, and he's supporting the TPP, and he wants to deregulate the banks. And I think that would be a crucial error if she would choose him, and that's the line they stick with, because that would just tell the progressives who were backing Bernie or are on the fence for Hillary that this is not the way to go. I think she would lose if
here's Congressman Connolly, Jerry Connolly.
I respectfully disagree. First of all, I believe our tent in the Democratic Party is big enough to have a multiplicity of views on a multiplicity of topics. And I don't like rigid orthodoxy being enforced by anybody. I would point out that Tim has never talked about deregulating or overturning Dodd-Frank. I think he wrote a letter trying to protect credit unions and small community banks in contradistinction to the big banks as they're looking at implementation of Dodd-Frank. I hardly think that's a mortal sin. He's a free trader. So was Hillary Clinton.
And so is Jerry Connolly.
And so am I.
He should
say. And in Virginia, that is the tradition, Democrat and Republican. Almost all of us, going back a long time, have been supporters because especially in Northern Virginia, ours is a knowledge-based economy. We want free movement of goods and services. But I don't see that as dispositive for Tim. And the caller seems to forget that Tim Kaine's record on gun control is far more progressive than the caller's candidate for president. And Tim Kaine had practical experience in this matter. He was the governor when, up to that point, the worst gun massacre in American history occurred at Virginia Tech. And he called for universal background checks. He called for closing the gun show loophole. And those were courageous stands in Virginia, and they remain courageous stands now. Tim has an unadulterated, progressive, pragmatic record in as mayor of Richmond, as lieutenant governor, as governor, and now as U.S. senator. And I think he owes no apologies to anyone for that record. And Hillary would be very well served with him as a running mate.
I think John's question that really gets to the problem that Tim Kaine sort of presents for Hillary, which is he's absolutely a progressive for Virginia, but for the contemporary Democratic Party nationally, where Bernie Sanders gave Hillary Clinton the fight of her life. The narrative is going to be this is the safe choice. This is not the progressive choice. This is somebody who is quite middle of the road and a party that's no longer middle of the road.
I don't agree with that. Bernie became a Democrat, at the beginning of the year. He doesn't define the Democratic Party. We're glad to have him. But some of us have been laboring in the vineyards for years, thank you very much, to build a progressive Democratic majority in Virginia and in the country. And if you look at Tim's voting record in the Senate, there's nothing that puts him on the sort of right of center of the Democratic Party. He is in the progressive tradition and in the mainstream of our Democratic caucus in the Senate. And that will serve him well.
The Democratic convention gets underway next week in Philadelphia. You will be there. It may not be, it probably won't be as controversial as the Republican National Convention, which may mean it may not be as watched as the RNC in Cleveland. Is that a good thing? What are you expecting next week?
I think there's a difference between entertainment and policy debate and propoundment. And so in that sense, yeah, maybe we're going to have less controversy on the floor. I pray to God that's true. But I do think that as Americans tune in, they're going to see some incredible stars, President Obama, President Clinton, I hope Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton herself, and many others, as opposed to sort of the B-list. And I think they're going to see a party seriously prepared to govern, well experienced in governing, and serious about a vision for America as opposed to only appealing to, the lesser part of our nature. We're going to be appealing to the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln talked about. And it's too bad the party of Lincoln has abandoned Lincoln.
Congressman, to what extent, we saw at the Republican convention this week appeals to anxiety, to fear, to security, that sort of message. Now, it could be easily said that Democrats, they would be well advised to sort of play the same game and say Donald Trump is a dangerous person. He's leading us down a road that is quite uncertain, that almost is as dire and bleak as the Republican message. Do you think that the Democrats are well advised to do that, to sort of do the LBJ versus Goldwater thing to say, you're electing and you're really taking a chance on this guy?
Well, yeah, you're right, Mike. Elections are always about the contrast, and ultimately you've got to do that. But it's got to be more than that, too. I don't want to see the Democrats descend into the pit the Republicans put themselves in. It's got to be more than that. Americans always vote on the future. What's the vision? What's the hope? How do we get out of problems we got? Acknowledging problems is not the same as saying they dominate our lives and characterize the country and the community we live in. That's not true. And so I think you're going to hear a counter-narrative next week that acknowledges problems and has prescriptions for them, which was notably absent this week in Cleveland.
Our guest is Jerry Connelly. He's a U.S. representative representing Virginia's 11th district. He's a Democrat. Our guest analyst is Mike DeBonis. He covers Congress and national politics for The Washington Post. I interrupted you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Kojo, that an example of that is, you know, Donald kind of cherry picked data on violence and homicides in America, conveniently overlooking the fact that, of course, the homicide rate has dropped precipitately in the United States since the 1970s, for example, at its highs, and that in more than half of the cities in America last year, it actually went down, not up. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have some problems. We do. Baltimore is a problem. Chicago is a problem. But what he refused to talk about, and in fact reaffirmed his belief that nobody should be without a gun. Well, the Democratic prescription for some of that violence is we got to get rational about gun safety in America. And that means, you know, somebody on the terror watch list shouldn't have a gun. Somebody mentally ill shouldn't have a gun. Someone accused of domestic abuse shouldn't have a gun. There ought to be universal background checks. Donald Trump had no connection between the experience of violence in some of our urban areas and the, you know, universal availability of guns in America. No other industrialized country rivals the United States in that respect.
800-433-8850 is the numbers. If you have questions or comments for Congressman Connelly, you can send email to kojo@wamu.org or join the show at our website, kojoshow.org. You can shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. You and the rest of Virginia's Democratic congressional delegation have been part of Hillary Clinton's leadership team in Virginia since last fall. Governor Terry McAuliffe at the helm of that effort. What's the strategy for this battleground state come between the convention in November?
Well, obviously, part of it's a geographic strategy, right? So you've got to have huge turnout to win Virginia as a Democrat in Northern Virginia. And in a lot of our most populous counties in the North, you've got to come out of there with 60% plus. We did that twice for President Obama, and I am fairly confident we can do it again for Hillary Clinton. But we can take nothing for granted. The demographic trends in Virginia are favoring us. And, of course, we got to, you know, work Virginia Beach, Hampton Roads, Norfolk, Newport News, the city of Roanoke, and Richmond and Charlottesville to get the Democratic vote out. And that's how you carry Virginia.
We got an email from Robin in Arlington who writes, I, for one, am quite disenchanted with Senator Kaine. Every time I contact him about an issue, I receive a two to three page reply that goes into great detail, most of which I already know or I wouldn't be contacting him in the first place, on the entire history and every aspect of the issue, and says absolutely nothing about his position or how he intends to vote. Is that the Tim Kaine you know?
No. Tim Kaine, I know, is very forthright, very direct. The other part the caller or the email respondent talks about most certainly reflects the policy wonk I know, Tim Kaine.
The two-three-page response.
He is very thorough. It's the very opposite of say, Donald Trump. He doesn't shoot from the hip. He is a very reflective person and shows respect for other points of view, even those that may be unalterably opposed to his own, something singularly lacking also in the Cleveland Convention.
What are assuming Tim Kaine it turns out to be Hillary Clinton's choice, what are Americans who don't know nothing about Tim Kaine, what are they going to be surprised by about him as they get to know him? What did Virginians know about him, and especially people like yourself who have worked with him, that regular Americans are going to get to know?
I think, unlike Mike Pence and Donald Trump, what we're going to be struck with is a very sunny personality. This is a positive, forward-looking person whose life experience tells him we can make it better. There's every promise we can do that if we just work together. And he's practiced what he preached. Remember, he comes from local government, and that's where you have to actually deliver. And he did. He was elected in a black city as a white mayor. He has this very strong civil rights record, and was a pragmatic, progressive governor and now senator. And I think they're also going to learn that this is an honorable person. Highly motivated. His religious faith and his experience overseas, where he learned fluent Spanish, inform him and inform him to this day. I can remember once going to the governor's mansion, and he was giving me a tour. And on his bedstand was a book about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran theologian who gave his life to fight the Nazi Orthodoxy at the time in Germany. Great hero of Christianity. And I am a big fan of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I was so impressed that my governor was reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is a highly moral person, authentic, genuinely motivated to do good.
Right. But the conventional wisdom, of course, is that the part of the vice president's job is to be the attack dog, to go for the jugular when necessary. Does Tim Kaine have it in him, in his Jesuit-educated schoolboy persona, to be the guy to take out Donald Trump when necessary?
I will remind you, Mike, yeah, that's all true. But he's also a politician and has a pretty good track record of putting away opponents. He beat, you know, Kilgore. He beat George Allen. These are not trivial figures in the Republican, constellation in Virginia, and he did it with great skill. He's a very formidable debater.
We'll get back to Senator Kaine in a second, because that's what some of our listeners wanted to do. But you're in Washington, so we got to talk D.C. statehood. It got a chilly reception in Cleveland this week. The GOP platform outright rejected the proposal. And while it may get a nod at the DNC in Philly next week, it really rests with Congress. And in theory, Congress and the president could make the district a state with a simple up or down vote signed into law by the president, the so-called Tennessee way. But what are the chances of that actually happening?
Zero, so long as the Congress is a Republican Congress. As you know, Kodjo, all of my career, I have favored D.C. voting rights. And if the way to do that is statehood, I favor statehood. I favor budget autonomy. I favor Congress staying out of the knickers of Washington, D.C. And I actually pointed out to my colleagues in the last fight we had in our committee, where they had a vote to actually strip D.C. of some of its rights and actions. Look, if you really want to get into that granularity, why don't we do the rezoning for D.C.? Let's actually get into rezoning. I used to do that. I didn't run for Congress to do it again.
But I guess you're Mayor Bowser, if you're listening, I think Congressman Connolly would like a seat on the D.C. Zoning Commission.
So no, I don't want it, but apparently my Republican colleagues do.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, when the statehood conversation comes up, one of the obstacles that is frequently discussed, it's not the largest obstacle, but it's a significant obstacle, are the Maryland and Virginia delegations who don't want the prospect of their constituents' tax dollars getting paid to the District of Columbia rather than to the states of Maryland or Virginia. Is that still a serious obstacle, or do you think that the four senators in Maryland and Virginia and the House delegations are willing to look past that to right the injustice of D.C. not having the same rights as other residents in the United States?
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to, Mike, in terms of our tax dollars.
The commuter tax issue.
Oh, a commuter tax. Well, whether D.C. were a state or in its current status, a commuter tax, in my opinion, is a very unwise thing because, frankly, it invites retribution. I mean, do you know how many residents of D.C. commute to my jurisdiction for work?
But D.C. as a state would have the same right to tax income added.
And Virginia and Maryland would have the same right to retaliate. It would not be good policy for D.C., in my opinion. It would backfire. It would be a very short-term, short-sighted kind of thing. And I think would actually discourage investment in D.C.
Back to Senator Tim Kaine. Put on your headphones, DeBonis, because I'd like to go to two different views. We'll start with Paul in Bedford, New Hampshire. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call, Kodjo. I'm listening to the very interesting commentary from the congressman, and I'm just struck by these themes of the solid citizen that Tim Kaine is, his Jesuit background, the fact that he knows who Dietrich Bonhoeffer was. I'm telling you, the average voter wouldn't know Dietrich Bonhoeffer from Joseph Goebbels. What this election cycle has shown more than anything else, especially with the Trump voters, is that perception is reality. I really think that picking a very reliable policy wonk guy who's a great person in his own right, but unexciting to the kinds of people that can make the difference in the margin, the tight margin that's going to play out in this election, it's a missed opportunity. I'd much rather see a firebrand that would bring the kind of passion and excitement that energizes
who do you have in mind?
Bernie voters than somebody who is
Who do you have in mind?
Democratic citizen.
Who do you have in mind?
Oh, well, you know, I live next to Massachusetts. I think Elizabeth Warren would naturally bring that kind of excitement. She's already proven it.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that with us. We do have to move on because Shauna in Washington, D.C. has a slightly different view. Shauna, your turn.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a longtime Democrat. I'm fairly moderate, and I'm for Hillary. And I'm very irritated by the fact that, you know, Bernie Sanders a year ago, he was not a Democrat. He was a socialist. He joined the Democratic Party just to run for president. You know, if you want to be on the left and be liberal and be a socialist, run as a socialist or independent. I don't appreciate, you know, people who vote for him that are, you know, trying to pull Hillary to the left. And we're putting so much focus on him. I really feel like, you know, as a party, it should be about what
you think he's he hijacked your party.
Absolutely hijacked. Every time I hear him and through the whole primary season, I was just very irritated by him because he's a socialist. He does not represent my party has represented for so
Shauna,
many years.
Thank you very much for your call. Congressman Connolly, our last two callers are the people that the Democratic National Convention next week have to bring together.
Well, they're already together, Kojo. I mean, there have been a lot of, you know, typical stories as there were 8 years ago. You know, all the Hillary Clinton supporters would never vote for Barack Obama. Well, they did. And if you look at polling data, most of the Bernie Sanders people have come into the fold again. I respectfully take issue with the last caller. I think Bernie Sanders made a great contribution. She's right. He was a socialist until last year and hasn't really been an active member of promoting the Democratic Party or its interests, but he does caucus with Democrats. I think he actually made a huge contribution in energizing a different voice within our party and for the country and highlighting some issues that needed highlighting. And I think he's being a loyal soldier, and I think we're going to see that both at the convention and on the campaign trail to recognize the threat of Donald Trump and to promote Hillary Clinton. And I respect that and applaud it. The other caller, by the way, I missed the point I was making about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't expect people to know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer necessarily is. But what I was struck by was this reflective man who has an active spiritual life, and that he is looking at someone I myself have been inspired by. I was so impressed with that this is what informs him. He's not some policy wonk in an ivory tower. He's an active, you know, red-blooded politician who has been in the arena and has always won.
Running out of time very quickly, but Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe restored the voting rights to more than 200,000 felons, but the constitutionality of the move has been challenged. Earlier this week, Virginia State Supreme Court heard oral arguments. How critical is that case in a key state like Virginia, and what do you expect the outcome to be?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be dispositive, frankly. I mean, I think the number of people who have actually benefited from that and registered to vote is something like 11,000. So it's not a huge number, and it's not going to tilt the state one way or the other, probably. But the question is, what is the right thing to do? And I will point out that it isn't just Democratic Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia currently. His predecessor, Republican Bob McDonnell, also felt that it was an injustice and was moving to liberalize the procedure to reinstate the voting rights of former felons.
Any final questions for Congressman Collins?
Congressman, you're going to be in Philadelphia next week.
Yeah.
What do you want to accomplish while you're there? What needs to happen in Philadelphia to bring Democrats together? What do you want to hear from Bernie Sanders, and what do you want to hear from Hillary Clinton?
I think the biggest single contribution is a message of vision and hope. Here's our plan. We're not just going to appeal to grievances. We're actually going to have, an orchestrated, carefully delineated, and articulated plan for the future that takes us to a better place than the dystopian world of Cleveland this last week.
Congressman Jerry Connolly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jerry Connolly represents Virginia's 11th district. He's a Democrat. Mike DeBonis is our guest analyst today. He covers Congress and national politics for The Washington Post. Joining us next will be Phil Mendelson, chair of the D.C. Council. But in the meantime, DeBonis, who do you want to cover as the next senator coming from Maryland? Because Maryland Governor Larry Hogan has endorsed State House Minority Whip Kathy Saliga on Tuesday. She is considered an underdog against Representative Chris Van Hollen. He's already in office. He has wider name recognition. He has more money. But in the final analysis, it's likely to be one of those two individuals who will be showing up. Who do you want to show up?
Who do I want to show up? Well,
who would you rather cover?
Well, I'm not in the business of picking the people that I get to cover. Otherwise, you know, perhaps the D.C. Council would look a lot different. No, I'm just kidding.
You think Barbara Mikulski should stay on? Huh?
Well, Barbara Mikulski is a Senate institution.
Great to cover
par excellence.
Too.
Great to cover. Great with a quote. You know, Chris Van Hollen, I think the folks who work on the Hill know him well. They know that he's, you know, what to expect with him. He's, you know, certainly been a good Democrat and has worked hard for his party during his years in the House. You know, Kathy Saliga, we don't know too much about her, you know, from the Hill. But, you know, how long has it been since there's been a Republican senator from Maryland? I believe you have to go back to Mac Mathias. I could be wrong about that.
Sure do.
If she were to be elected, it would be a huge upset. Certainly one that would, you know, go down in the annals, right next to Larry Hogan's upset of Anthony Brown. Certainly,
because Governor Hogan would say I was an upset candidate, so she can do it too.
But I think a Senate race is even different from a governor's race in Maryland. I think that there is a history. You know, you don't have to go all that far back to Bob Ehrlich of a Democratic state electing Republican governors. Republican senators, you know, being sent from a blue state, sending a red lawmaker into the rough and tumble of Washington, somebody with, you know, more or less orthodox Republican positions would be extremely surprising. And that's, I think that still to this day, I stay in touch with the forecasters and the folks in the national party apparatus. And I don't think that anyone is really looking at Maryland yet as a surprise state.
Joining us now in studio is Phil Mendelson. He is the chairman of the D.C. Council. Phil Mendelson, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here.
I wanted to know what you made of Donald Trump's speech at the RNC last night, in particular because he mentioned the district and not exactly in the most flattering terms. Here's what he had to say.
Homicides last year increased by 17% in America's 50 largest cities. That's the largest increase in 25 years. In our nation's capitals, killings have risen by 50%.
Phil Mendelson.
Yes, sir. The data is a little out of date. And I don't know what else to say.
Mayor Bowser responded on Twitter, noting that homicides are actually down 9% in D.C. from this time last year. But it's like apples and oranges because he was talking about last year. She's talking about since that time last year.
Well, I think that the Republican nominee was speaking in contemporary terms. He wasn't talking about history. He was talking about the state of the nation and the state of the district today.
I thought you would parse it in that way, because in his previous remarks he was talking about last year, but when it came to the district, he seemed to be speaking contemporarily.
I mean, however you want to couch it, he made the district look unsafe and dangerous, and statistically, in terms of crime, that's just not the case. I certainly don't want to be dismissive of the fact that we have robberies and we have homicides and we have a lot of violent crime. But it's not dire the way he was painting, but I think that's consistent with the way his whole speech ran, which, as you all said at the top of the show, was a depressing view of our country. which I really find kind of remarkable. I think that's a way to campaign for office, to say things are horrible and I'm the one who will make it better. But if you think about it, if the Republicans have been talking about making America great again for each presidential election for as long as I can remember, I think we have a very good story in the district, not just in terms of crime, but just overall. This is an exciting place for people to live. That's why population is growing. Financially, the government is very healthy. We're just seeing nightlife.
We're getting a Trump hotel. What kind of relationship would
that wasn't on my list, Coach.
What kind of relationship would you expect that President Trump might have with the district?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on what it would be, but based on the rhetoric so far, he's clearly not interested in understanding exactly what's going on in the district. When he was asked a couple months ago about whether he would support statehood, not only was he unable to speak to the issue, but he couldn't even speak to the fundamental principles, which is that we lack voting representation in the national legislature, unlike the national capital of every country in the free world. He couldn't speak to self-determination. He couldn't speak to basic United States citizenship rights for residents of the District of Columbia.
Well, go ahead.
I would just say, but it has to be said, Donald Trump, Mr. Chairman, is he's a different sort of character than we've seen in Republican nominees. He actually has met most of the district's political leadership. He's spoken well of the mayor. He's been on podiums with the members of the council.
He shared shovels with them.
He actually seems to have like some personal relationships. His daughter Ivanka knows. I think the mayor and the council members actually quite well on a working basis. I don't think we've ever had this sort of familiarity before with a presidential candidate. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Has this familiarity bred contempt?
No, but I also, the picture that Mike is painting is not the one. I talked to my colleagues on the council, and nobody's ever spoken of their personal connection to Donald Trump. But, maybe you're right. I've not met the man or his daughter or his wife. I know that when I first was elected, Bill Clinton reached out to the local elected leadership on occasion after occasion. There was a relationship there.
Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton's wife, is going to be the Democratic nominee, could be the president. She has seemed to have said all the right things that you would want a Democratic nominee to say about the district. She supports statehood forthrightly, said so early in her campaign. But what reason did district residents have to think that her relationship to the district is going to be more positive, more progressive, and actually accomplish some real advances in autonomy and civil rights for the district that we didn't get under Barack Obama or even Bill Clinton?
A lot of people have speculated about that, and I don't know what will really happen. I'm hopeful, and I think everybody is hopeful that Hillary Clinton will be far more supportive of the district than we have seen. This is what we see with every election is rhetoric. Home rule came to the district under Richard Nixon, a Republican, mm-hmm. and one who's has not been well respected since, not because of home rule, of course. There are always surprises who are going to be our friends and who are not going to be our friends. But we're hopeful. She has said the right things, and she's not a stranger to the district. Absolutely not a stranger to the district. So presumably she knows what she's talking about when she makes the statements.
But when the rubber hits the road, what we've seen time and again is that when Democratic politicians, they say the right things, but when the time comes to actually do something about it,
that's true, and that's
DC moves down the list of priorities.
We have to change that, and the way we change it is to try to change the political temperature on the issue across the country, a point that I've made over and over again. We do a very good job in the district of talking to ourselves and convincing ourselves of that which we already believe. And I think we also do very limited, what I call one-off forays outside the district to try to get support. I think that the data suggests, and when I say data, there have been polls from time to time, that when people are asked about rights, basic citizen rights for the citizens of the district, people across the country support us. But nobody's focused on this, and they're not focused on this because it doesn't affect anybody directly except residents of the district. Well, we can get them thinking about it more if we think through a more comprehensive political strategy, meaning a national strategy, than we have.
Our guest is Phil Mendelson. He chairs the D.C. Council. You can, if you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. As we discussed earlier, the GOP platform rejects D.C. statehood. But last week, the council voted unanimously to put a referendum on D.C. statehood on the ballot in November. However, some advocates complained that D.C. residents didn't have much say and that the process is being rushed through. To which you say what?
Well, those who complain that they've not had adequate opportunity, they will have more opportunity. The council will have at least one hearing in September or October on the proposed draft constitution, and if 100 people sign up, we'll hear from 100 people. I'm sensitive to the fact that people feel that there was not enough input. But the constitution is only a piece of the strategy. The overall strategy is that with a new Congress and president in January of 2017, that we renew our request, our petition for statehood. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And the mayor laid out a process, which I think also makes a lot of sense. Not that we do this in December, but that we do this starting in April. That means a couple of months ago. And that's what we've done. There are people who complain that the so-called constitutional convention really wasn't a convention, and maybe, but on the other hand, there was night after night where people came and they spoke and they said what they wanted to say. Some feel that they weren't heard, but as I said, they will have another opportunity to be heard. This process isn't over, it's continuing, but the goal is to renew our request in January, and I think that's reasonable.
When will the process be over, though? I mean, we're asking people to vote in November.
Yeah.
People are actually going to start voting early in October once early voting starts. Will the Constitution be finished in, at that point? Will people know what they are voting on? Is there a timeline, especially since it sounds like the council isn't going to take action until they come back from their recess around Labor Day? Is this thing going to be wrapped up in time so people know what they're voting on?
Wrapped up and tied with a bow? No. But what folks are going to be voting on November 8th is the fundamental question, do citizens of the district support the district moving forward with statehood? Do they support our petition for statehood? There will be reference in that. It's an advisory referendum, so it's not a ratification. There'll be a reference to this process of drafting the Constitution. So there's been a lot of focus on that. But the fundamental question, and actually when you look at the wording, is do folks approve of our petitioning for statehood?
Well, you just heard Congressman Connolly say that the chances are slim and none. So what's the point of this referendum?
Well, then let's just give up and go home, Kojo. But I don't think that's the way to do it. I think we have to continue to press. And as I said a couple minutes ago, I really think that we, and that's those who care about the issue, the groups that are focused on this issue, the shadow representatives, and the rest of us in government need to come up with a much more powerful national strategy that changes the politics on this. We're right. There's no question that it's fundamental in America that folks have representation in the National Congress and that the citizens of every state have the same rights and responsibility of every, across the country, and that should include the people in the District of Columbia. We're just right on this morally.
We talked about the homicide rate in D.C. Last week, Police Chief Kathy Lanier announced that robberies had been reduced, quote-unquote, almost 20%. Washington Post disputed those numbers, saying their analysis shows the number of robberies up by 3% and the number of gunpoint robberies increasing more than 20%. Why is this discrepancy?
Well, it's not so much a discrepancy, and I hate to kind of get into this because
it's in the weeds. It's different ways of calculating.
Yeah, everybody will get lost on this. But the mayor, as I recall, looked at the last 215 days and compared it with the same 215 days a year ago, the 215 days before the 215 days. It was not a year-to-year comparison. There are many ways to slice and dice statistics. If you look at year-to-year, whether that's this month, compared to the same month last year, or this year, year to date, compared with last year, year to July 22nd, you get a comparison. Violent crime is up. It's up about 3%. Robberies are, if I remember correctly, the difference in robberies is 3 out of 1,675. Homicides are down. That's what the numbers are. If you compare year to date this year with year to date.
Wait, hold on a second, because crime is precisely what Jim in Washington, D.C. wants to talk about. So don your headphones, and here is Jim. You're on the air. Jim, go ahead, please.
Hey, happy hot Friday, everyone. I just wanted to, your guest said earlier about his perception from Mr. Trump's speech last night.
On crime.
About him painting a gloom and doom type of portrait. And I'm a Trump supporter, but I didn't get that at all. I got my perception was we're headed in the wrong direction, and these are things that need to be addressed. And I think it's slightly irresponsible to portray it that way in the public eye, because you're persuading people that are,
Do you think a crime wave is sweeping the country and the District of Columbia?
I think crime is out of control right now. I think
we have
organizing, and they're basically in country terrorist groups attacking police officers and they're stopping people from progressing in their lives.
Does it matter at all? And I guess Phil Mendelson, you should respond.
Well, I think I don't know what to say when somebody says crime is out of control. There should be no crime. And to the extent that there is crime, one could say that we're not doing a very good job of controlling public safety. Of course, we could be very dictatorial as a government and really restrict freedoms and in that way ensure that there's no crime. And I know the caller's not suggesting that at all. Crime is not significantly worse year-to-date this year than it was a year ago. So I don't think we've lost control. I'm trying to remember, I think Jerry Connolly talked about this. We can do better, and we ought to do better. And it's a core function of government, public safety. The homicides are down compared to a year ago. That's the statistic that's the most accurate and that people look to the most. The homicide rate is lower today in the district than it's been, and that's because our population is growing while the number of homicides is down slightly. But our homicide rate is not where New York was a few years ago. I haven't looked most recently. We got a ways to go, and people have a right to feel safe. But I wouldn't say it's out of control.
Well, to paraphrase the famous saying, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, and then there's crime statistics, where it all depends. Depends on what time frame you're looking at, what particular offenses you're looking at, whether you're looking at the local numbers or the FBI numbers, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme, homicides were up significantly last year,
yes,
in 2015, over 2014, which was a historic low for the last 20, 30 years in the district.
40 years
in the District of Columbia.
Yes.
We're still not down to that 2014 level in 2016.
Not
We're
close.
Down a little bit. That said, in the grand scheme, over the past 20, 30 years, there has been a significant reduction in crime.
Yes.
That said, you have to look at what accounts for the increases we've seen in the last couple of years. And I know that that's a matter of great debate, even within the police department, within the council. We had a big debate in City Hall this year about the best way to address that. That said, in the long term view, crime is nowhere near the bad old days of the late 80s, early 90s.
That's
beyond
true
that.
As well.
And I just want to respond to Jim. And, when I talked about the mood of that speech last night.
Were you the one who said doom and gloom?
It's sort of, yeah.
And I thought that.
I compare that to, Republican rhetoric of basically the last 35 years, which was basically defined by Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan talked about the evil empire and the Soviet threat and existential threats to the United States. But he also talked about morning America and city on a hill, and we got no morning in America. We got no city on the hill from Donald Trump.
Yes, if you're talking about prescriptions and so forth. Yeah, it was kind of short on that.
Right.
You know, it's very easy to say that the good old days were the good old days. But, you know, when you think about it, as long as I've been alive, people have always talked about today being worse than the good old days. I mean, that's year after year and decade after decade and presidential campaign after presidential campaign.
And the fact of the matter is that in the 70s, 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, crime was much worse in general than it is today.
Yeah.
People tend to forget that. But on a more upbeat note, there's a new advertising campaign to generate excitement for the D.C. streetcar. There's even a jingle.
Cool shops, restaurants, and arts along D.C.'s newest attraction, the D.C. Streetcar. There's a whole new world of fun along H Street and Benning Road. What a ride! And it's free! Go to dcstreetcar.com for all the details.
That
you guys have to stop giggling on this.
This is part of an advertising campaign costing more than $200,000. Is the idea that listening to this tune will make us want to ride the streetcar?
Well, one hopes so. You know, it's a good thing to advertise. I did not know that the government was going to spend money on a promotional campaign. But I've often thought that the streetcar line on H Street Northeast is about creating a very unique commercial strip. And I think doing this advertisement is consistent with that, and I'm hopeful that it will result in additional business. You know, oftentimes what we do, we in the district government, is we say, well, it's built, and therefore they will come. That's a bad paraphrase. But we do that about the district as a whole and tourism and 8th Street. And so I don't know if there's anything wrong with advertising to
get more business. Well, we're out of time.
There.
We built this studio, and we're glad you came. Phil Mendelson is chair of the D.C. Council. Mike DeBonis is covering Congress and national politics for The Washington Post. That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening online. It's going to be hot this weekend, making it a great time to stay inside with a good book. Head to kojoshow.org/blog to check out our cruise summer reading suggestions. And if reading seems too taxing, you can catch up on past broadcasts of this show by subscribing to it via your favorite podcast app. Whatever your plans, stay cool and be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking about questions raised after the death of an inmate at D.C. Central Jail and concerns about conditions in the aging facility, especially during a heat wave. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Kam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.